last case of the morning is Smith against Potter.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Sandra Blevins. I'm an attorney for plaintiff appellant Kathy Smith. This case is about an unrepresented layperson who did her best and was diligent in pursuing her claim of discrimination against the Postal Service, but has been thwarted at every turn. Ms. Smith has continued to pursue this claim for almost 7 years because she strongly believes that she was treated unjustly by the Postal Service. And I only mention these underlying facts briefly. They're not at issue before the court now, but there were some misstatements in the record, and I just want to make those clear. The underlying facts of the case actually are quite compelling. An African-American supervisor at the Postal Service vandalized Ms. Smith, who's white, vehicle, while on postal property in time, beat up Ms. Smith while on postal time, and made repeated harassing phone calls to Ms. Smith while on postal property in time. This African-American supervisor did not receive any discipline for these acts. Ms. Smith, when she retaliated against the African-American supervisor, was disciplined, and it is these acts that she has brought a claim for discrimination. Ms. Smith was suspended on October 4th, 1998 for her acts. Within a week of that suspension, she contacted the EEOC and was told that if she was going to bring a union grievance, which she indicated she was, that she would need to contact the EEOC after that union grievance was final. The union grievance was played out and a final decision was made by the arbitrator on June 6, 2001. Ms. Smith contacted the EEOC after that on June 11, 2001 and filed a formal complaint on June 27th. Ms. Smith timely filed her claim of discrimination and followed the rules that she was supposed to follow because she did timely contact the EEOC within 45 days of the discriminatory act after she was suspended. These facts are unrefuted and undisputed by the Postal Service. Ms. Smith made this allegation that she contacted the EEOC in a timely manner. The district court, in reviewing this case, did not address this timeliness claim in the way that it was presented to the court. The district court only considered this issue in terms of equitable estoppel. However, in the first section of our response brief on summary judgment, the very first section says, Ms. Smith timely filed her claim, timely contacted the EEOC within 45 days. The Postal Service has argued on appeal that we waived that argument, but I would respectfully submit that we did not waive that argument. We said, first and foremost, that she timely contacted the EEOC within 45 days. And for the district court to determine otherwise in summary judgment, a credibility determination had to be made that Ms. Smith was not telling the truth. And on summary judgment, credibility determinations cannot be made on summary judgment. And for this reason alone, we believe that summary judgment should be reversed because a credibility determination had to be made for the court to not consider Ms. Smith's allegation that she timely contacted the EEOC within 45 days as she was required to do. If, in addition, we have argued that Ms. Smith is entitled to equitable estoppel because the EEOC gave her incorrect information when she contacted them. Now, the Postal Service has indicated that Ms. Smith had good information that she should rely on, such as posters and so forth, but of course the posters were not available to her when she was suspended and banned from the workplace. At the time when she needed them the most, she did not have access to them. And so we do not believe that those posters should be used as a sword against Ms. Smith. In addition, I would note that the poster states If a claimant has questions, they should contact the EEOC. And Ms. Smith did so and was told to wait until after her arbitration, after her union grievance had completed the process. As soon as that union grievance was completed, she did contact the EEOC. She followed through, and the EEOC ultimately determined that Ms. Smith had made a timely contact with the EEOC and that her claim was timely. Unfortunately, Ms. Smith had already filed suit in federal court when the EEOC made that determination. She requested the federal court to remand it to the EEOC, which the district court did not do. One of the other questions to be considered by this court is what kind of review should be made and what kind of deference should be given to the EEOC's determination that her claim was timely. And I believe, or we believe, strongly believe, that the district court should have given deference to that EEOC determination.
How would deference ever be appropriate in a case subject to a de novo judicial proceeding?
Your Honor, I understand that it is a de novo judicial proceeding.
You would surely, had the EEOC taken a different view, be here arguing that review is de novo, as the Supreme Court said in Brown and Chandler.
Your Honor, I understand that. But
if it's de novo, it's de novo both ways.
Well, there can be some difference between a looking at discrimination and looking at procedural issues. The EEOC regulation...
Is there any basis for that in the Supreme Court's opinion in Brown or Chandler?
I believe that... I cannot point the court specifically to that, to something in Brown or Chandler that would indicate that is possible, but I don't think that it indicates that it's not possible. I think what we have here is... This court in McGinnis versus the Postal Service indicated that this same regulation that we're dealing with, which is 29 CFR 1642.5,
which doesn't discuss either of the Supreme Court's cases dealing with the standard of review.
The de novo standard of review?
It doesn't mention either Brown or Chandler.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the Postal Service in its response raised that issue about de novo review, and we had not addressed that initially in our brief. We do not follow the proper grammar because we felt like the court had everything before it that it needed, and I'm certain that the court doesn't want to read anything in addition to what it doesn't have to read. And we believe that everything was before the court as it was, but we did argue in our brief that the EEOC regulation should be given deference, and we did argue that to the court in our brief. The de novo review, though, I would say by the Supreme Court, while it's true with regard to discrimination matters, I believe with regard to procedure, the EEOC should be given deference, and indeed, if it's not given deference, then the regulation that is at issue here has no force in effect. And this court found in Guinness that this regulation is broadly worded and gives the EEOC broad discretion to determine whether a claimant has made a timely claim. At the end of the regulation, it says, the commission shall extend the 45-day time limit for other reasons considered sufficient by the agency or the commission. If the EEOC does not have discretion to determine whether a claimant made a timely claim, then this regulation has no force in effect. If the district court does not have to give deference to that determination by the EEOC, then this regulation... It would have to be found invalid, and this court has already found that it is valid and that it is broadly worded to allow the EEOC to have discretion in these matters. And indeed, in McGinnis, this court remanded a case back to the EEOC and dismissed the claim with prejudice, not because it was barred, but because the individual needed to exhaust their administrative remedies. In this case, I would say that Ms. Smith did exhaust her administrative remedies. She did timely contact the Postal Service. And unless there are questions now, I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Ms. Richards.
Good
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Deborah Richards, and I'm the Assistant United States Attorney who is representing Johnny Potter, the Postmaster General, in this case. Before I begin my argument, I would like to address the point made that the plaintiff has made argument that this October 1998 phone call to the EEO office to an unknown female was a complaint as found under the CFR, and that constituted a complaint. That argument was not made in the lower court, and certainly was not made on appeal here, where she simply challenged the credibility determination by the district court. There was no argument made as to how that type of contact could constitute the beginning of an informal complaint. There's certainly no cause number was assigned or anything of that type. Moreover, at the time that phone call had been made, which was within a week of her suspension, that would have been the week of October 5th, she had not yet received her notice of proposed removal. She didn't receive that until October the 22nd, 1998. And therefore, she couldn't have been making a complaint as to her removal because it wasn't ripe yet. She didn't know what the outcome of the investigation would be. And because she hadn't received it yet, she was not making a contact at that time to file her complaint regarding her removal, which she learned about later, as I said. Indeed, the only way that this phone call comes into relevance is under the equitable estoppel argument. No matter how you look at this case, no matter what angle you look at this case, Ms. Smith failed to exhaust her administrative remedies. There is no question, it is undisputed, that between November the 27th, 1998, and January 11th, 1999, which was 45 days after the effective date of her removal, that she did not contact the EEO office. And there's no dispute that she did contact the EEO office on February 3rd, 1999, and she filed an informal complaint at that time, received a cause number, and began the procedures to pursue her claim for her removal. However, when she went to mediation on that case, she voluntarily withdrew that claim and decided not to pursue it. So it's undisputed that on those two times, she did not exhaust her administrative remedies. The district court correctly then looked at the evidence and gave full value to the phone call that was made in October, did not question her credibility, accepted it as was, and looked to equitable estoppel to see if that would allow Ms. Smith to excuse her failure to exhaust her administrative remedies and continue forward. In looking at those elements, it is the plaintiff's burden to present evidence of that, and she failed to do so at the district court level, and because of that, her claim fails. Even beyond that, however, she had to show that she actually relied upon this information she got in October and that she did so reasonably. She cannot show either of those. She didn't actually rely upon the information because on February 3rd, 1999, she indeed filed an informal complaint, received a cause number, and began pursuing that complaint. So she didn't rely upon it. She also, it was not reasonable for her to rely upon it. There's been mention of the posters that were throughout the facility in numerous locations, which informed Ms. Smith of who to contact, gave her the phone number and the address to contact, under what circumstances she should contact anytime she felt that she was being discriminated against, and that she was to do so within 45 days of the discriminatory event. Those posters were up from at least 1993, available to Ms. Smith throughout that time.
If within 45 days of effective date of her termination, it was sometime in November of 98, within 45 days, she would have filed a contact with the EEOC, and whatever she did would have been sufficient to have them open up a case file or something like that.
But the EEOC have done anything different than tell her, we'll sit on this until your grievance, it took a long, quite a long time here, 3 years, to resolve a grievance that went to arbitration. That seemed like a long time, but is that what the EEOC would have done?
No, in fact, that's not what they did on February 3rd, 1999, when she did contact them. They accepted her complaint, they gave it a cause number, and she began to look at it. We know that Ms. Smith states that she was told by an unknown EEO counselor that they could not help her until the union grievance process was complete. But indeed, the evidence is that they did accept her complaint. Aurora contended she could not reasonably rely upon that representation that she was given in October because of the posters. On February 12th, after she filed her complaint, she received an EEO booklet as well. And this booklet, when you look through it, tells her about the 45 days. It tells her what to expect if you withdraw your case, that it's done, it's over with, within that booklet. And it also does describe to her what parallel proceedings are as far as a grievance process and an EEO process. So on February 12th, she was given this booklet that would explain to her that generally those proceedings were going on in parallel with each other unless there's written agreement that the EEO proceedings would be deferred until the grievance process was completed. So she had all that information available to her. So we say, the government says that she has not cannot reasonably rely upon it. Beyond that, she also has to show that the government took affirmative misconduct, had sort of a deliberate design or took deliberate steps to prevent her from timely filing her suit. And again, there's...
You mean from timely making an administrative claim?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. From timely making that administrative claim. And this single phone call really doesn't show that type of active prevention from asserting her rights necessary. Indeed, they accepted her claim in February 1999. And she could have called back. She could have made a written complaint even after she received her notice of proposed removal. The district court correctly found that Ms. Smith had not produced sufficient evidence to warrant application of equitable estoppel, and we would ask the court to affirm its opinion on that. As far as whether this later Office of Federal Operations determination should be deferred to, there are several reasons why it should not. First and foremost is that court or that administrative body did not have jurisdiction over the claim at the time that it made its decision. And under 29 CFR 1614.409, its authority was terminated the very day that she filed her federal claim, which was on June 3, 2002. And so that decision was void to begin with. As this court has indicated also, the district court has de novo review of those actions, and certainly if the OFO decision had said that it was not timely, we probably wouldn't have this argument before us at this time. And in addition, that opinion is just simply against the Seventh Circuit law as to when a claim accrues. With respect to the McGinnis case that was mentioned, that is an equitable tolling case, not equitable estoppel case. But beyond that, the holding is that you must, and the importance of that case is that you must exhaust your administrative remedies. And in this case, Ms. Smith did not. No matter how you look at this case, it's just she did not exhaust her administrative remedies. She did not give the agency an opportunity to look at the facts of her case and to make an opinion on that. For these reasons, and those stated in the government's brief, unless there are further questions, we would request that this court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Richards.
Thank you very much.
Anything further, Ms. Gladys?
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms.
just want to make a couple of points. This is the first time I've heard that Ms. Smith, now her claim was too early. Her call to the EEOC was too early. This is the first time I've heard that argument. It's always been that everything she's done was too late. But in any event, I believe that Ms. Smith knew on October 4th, 1998, that she likely would be removed. And so she did contact the EEOC, and I don't think she should be penalized for contacting them as soon as she believed that something discriminatory was occurring. Secondly, with regard to the February complaint, I would point out to the court that she brought that claim as a result of the denial of step two of her grievance. And the thrust of that complaint was that there were three males who... I'm sorry, my time is up, Your Honor. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be at recess until tomorrow.